Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to Voice of Vashon webcast in real time at voiceofvashon.org, also available on archive and broadcast on Comcast Channel 21. Today is the last day of the 2013 Port Townsend Writers Conference, and I am lucky enough to be able to sit down with Patricia Henley and chat a little bit. Patricia has published 4 collections of short stories, 2 novels. Her first novel, Hummingbird House, was a finalist for the National Book Award, and she's currently working on a young adult novel with Elizabeth Stuckey French. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
I'm happy to be here.
As a quick reminder to our listeners, since this is a new program for Voice of Vashon, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose has the simple goal of offering authors of fiction, memoir, and poetry an opportunity to discuss how they use their art to inspire social change. So I have found that authors have a very different perspective of that, and I like to start off just asking what it means to you, the idea of intersecting your literary art with sort of social activism or the human condition.
Well, I think stories can have a profound effect on people, much more than reading a book of nonfiction, as you mentioned earlier when we were talking before the interview. So if I have something that's on my mind, some social issue, I sometimes find a way to work it into fiction, thinking that stories have the power to change hearts and minds.
Right. So you find that you have some intentionality, like maybe something's just bugging you, or you just want to be able to talk about it, and then you're like, oh, I can put it in here? Is that how it might work?
Well, sometimes it might be something that I already know quite a bit about, just because of proximity to it, or an interest I've had in it. But oftentimes, those larger societal issues are aspects of a novel that require a lot of research. You know, my first novel, Hummingbird House, is set in Guatemala at the tail end of a very long civil war, and it required a lot of research to understand what was going on there. So in that case, I had to do a lot of extra work, which I loved. In the case of In the River Sweet, I did a lot of research about certain aspects of it, but one of the societal issues that I'm dealing with in The River Sweet is a hate crime against a lesbian couple.
Oh, wow.
In this small Indiana town. And that was something I already felt comfortable writing about because I was familiar with the lesbian community, and I'd heard of such hate crimes or read about them, and so I didn't need to research that. But the backstory of In the River Sweet is set in Vietnam, and it's about secrets that my two protagonists are harboring about their years during the Vietnam War. And so I had to go to Vietnam, and I had to do a lot of interviewing and researching to get that part right. So sometimes it's just something I want to write about, like a hate crime, and it doesn't require that much of me in terms of research. And other times when I want to write about larger issues, it requires a lot.
And In the River Sweet is your second novel, and it's the one you brought with you today to read from. Excellent. Would you like to do that now?
Sure. That sounds great. That'd I haven't awesome. Looked at this book in years, so.
When was it published?
2002.
Oh, wow.
2002. This is the very opening from Ruth Ann's point of view. Jesus would not say fag. She knew that much. Father Carroll said it. Limbo had laughed, but Limbo did not know any better. His job was to make sure the Johns were clean before Mass. He carried the cleaning supplies in a wooden box, like a toolbox, and whenever Ruth Ann walked by, she could smell the disinfectant, waxy, nearly toxic, the same odor there had been in her church growing up. It was a comfort to her. The boys and girls from the college had come to Father Carroll, and they wanted to put a sticker, a decal, on the church door. The decal was a symbol of them. They wanted to put the decal on the door, and it would let everyone know, all of them, that they were welcome at St. Joan's. They wanted a decal on every church and every restaurant and every public space in Tarkington, But that was quite a bit to hope for. She tried to tell Laurel that. Father Carroll had said, "No, we can't do that." "I understand your cause," he said, "but the bishop would not approve." He foisted it off on the bishop. He wanted to be liked, even by them. In the lunchroom, where they counted the Sunday collection, Ruth Ann wiped up a few granules of instant coffee Limbo had spilled. She gripped a sour sponge in her hand. A jackhammer vibrated outside the narrow window. Orange cones surrounded the jackhammer, and the few cars dipped around the man who operated it. Finals were over. Most of the students had left for the summer, and the streets and restaurants and dance clubs and parks were empty without them. Limbo hunched at the table, poking at the numbers on his cell phone with the eraser end of a pencil, waiting for his mother to pick him up. Once in a while, he would hiss, "Yes," to the game he played against himself. She was sure Father Carroll said it. He shook his head. It was the same way Limbo said, "Bless their little hearts," when he heard gossip. "Bless their hearts. It can't be helped." Laurel had said it can't be helped when she told Ruth Ann and Johnny. They called it coming out. She came out. Laurel was their only child, and she came out. Their baby. They still called her "our baby" the way you do, joking, but meaning it too. Laurel had said, "I'm 24 years old, and I want what you have, love and affection." So that's the opening, just part of the opening.
And you just dive right in.
You have to.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I love this because, you know, you start off maybe or maybe not with the inciting incident. I'm not sure. So the inciting incident is sort of like, how would you describe it?
Well, the inciting incident in this book doesn't happen until about page 37.
Right, but it's this important piece that you don't want to leave off too late, and it's sort of what the story takes mm-hmm. off from. Mm-hmm. And we've just been a week hanging out, you know, here at Centrum, having a wonderful time, being surrounded by people who, while they're focused on the inciting incident of their characters, I'm not sure if you've noticed this, but they all seem to have, as authors, an inciting incident in their own lives, which sort of has brought them mm-hmm. to this point where mm-hmm. they want to write. Mm-hmm. And so like Hummingbird House, you know, what would bring a woman to Guatemala? I think you said you traveled there 5 times. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious what you think about the inciting incidents in people's lives and how that relates to their desire to write and maybe share what they experience with their readers.
Well, maybe I could talk about it in relation to this book.
Yeah.
The inciting incident that happens in the River Suite is quite similar to something that happened to me on page 37 of the book. And so this is not a spoiler. I'm not giving away too much. Mm-hmm. Ruth Ann gets an email from her son that she left behind in Vietnam.
Oh.
And he says, "I think you are my mother." He's tracked her down. He's grown now. He's moved to the United States. He's a teacher. And she's in her 50s. This is a big secret that she's left behind.
Yeah, you don't hear of it being the woman who left a child. Usually it's the man who has.
I know.
Yeah.
And that's something that happened to me because I put up my daughter for adoption when she was a day old. And 27 years later, she found me. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly one of the big plot points in my life. And I wanted to find a way to work it into fiction. And so I gave the story to Ruth Ann and Johnny. Very different story. It's mm-hmm. fictionalized. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in Vietnam. My mm-hmm. daughter was born here in the States. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to deal with that issue of a child finding a mother years later. And so that was my inciting event that prompted mm-hmm. the writing of this book. And then it became about other things, that they are a family, Ruth Ann, Johnny, and their daughter. They're a family of people keeping secrets. Johnny's got his secrets from the war. Ruth Ann has that big secret. And their daughter is coming out as a lesbian woman in this mm-hmm. small community. And so they're kind of reaching critical mass
mm-hmm.
in terms of secrets.
Yeah, absolutely. And potentially all at the same time.
Yes, and that's what makes it...
Yeah. Wow.
Intense.
Wow. So there's a few other authors I'll be talking with in the next month or so who focus on poetry in particular. A lot of them do, although I know it works also in fiction. But using poetry to work through or to survive grief experiences, loss. So it seems like a gift in a way to me when a person, on one hand, you as the author can receive from writing and working through and processing something. But there are other people out there in the world who have gone through what you've gone through. And by writing this and taking it to a published place and allowing other people to be there with you, it seems like it's a gift, really, to let other people know they're not alone. I think that feeling of I'm alone is often so difficult. And once you know you're not alone, it's like a watershed moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're talking about for the reader.
For the reader, mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Surprising things have happened around that, too. I was told by some women involved in adoption, women looking to adopt, that Hummingbird House is a really important book in adoption circles.
Mm-hmm.
And because it has an adoption as well, an adoption of a little girl by my central character, Kate Banner. And I had no idea, you know, that people had latched on to that aspect of Hummingbird House.
Well, I just got chills.
And I was so happy.
It's amazing.
To hear that. And then I wrote another book about adoption. Mothering is something that is in all of my work, not intentionally. It just seems to be the part of life that I'm always working over.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really heartening. And then within The River Sweet, even though it's primarily about Johnny and Ruth Ann and her having left her child in Vietnam, I've heard from many, many gay and lesbian people that, oh, I gave this book to my mother to read. It means a lot to them because of the coming out issues and the hate crime.
Have any of them actually used it prior to coming out as a way of sort of...
I don't know.
So we haven't gotten specific stories like that yet.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, this is March Twisdale, and you're listening to my interview with Patricia Henley last summer in Port Townsend at the Centrum Writers Conference. I'd like to thank you for listening to the third installment of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose here on Voice of Vashon, webcast at voiceofvashon.org, and Comcast Channel 21. And now, back to the interview.
I just, you know, every time I talk with someone, my own belief, you know, the idea... And for those of you who are just tuning in, a quick reminder, you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon at voiceofvashon.org. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm talking today with Patricia Henley, who has been so kind as to share her insights, wisdom, and experience with all of us here at Centrum for the Port Townsend Writing Conference. And so even though I have my own beliefs around the power of fiction, everyone I talk to, it's like I get more reasons to believe and more stories and anecdotes of just how intensely people can be impacted by what they read.
Mm-hmm.
So place. We spent the whole week focusing on the power of place, the importance of place, the relevance of place. I'm curious about Hummingbird House, for which you were a finalist for the National Book Award. And if you could talk a little bit about, well, how did place matter? Like the choosing to go to Guatemala. I understand partially you were drawn to what had happened there. But I thought when you spoke about it earlier in one of our classes, that there was a story that a doctor told you about. Mm-hmm. That story probably in some ways occurs in different places around the world, but you chose that type of story. But you really chose to go there and to keep it grounded in Guatemala. I'm just curious.
Well, I don't think that particular story could be told anywhere in the world because that was about the Mayan people who were only there wanting to cut out the heart of that priest when he died and bury it behind their church. So that is a very specific locale, the Guatemalan Highlands.
Right.
Yeah. And the doctor told me about this American priest who had been killed during the violence, during the Civil War. And when his American relatives came to fetch his body, the Mayan people wanted to cut out his heart and bury it behind the church. And his relatives agreed that his heart did belong in the Guatemalan highlands. And I just thought that was a really powerful story, and that sent me on this path of investigating even further the Civil War, the plight of the Mayan people. Mm-hmm. And I think that book could only have been set in Guatemala. It's right. Comes right out of the Guatemalan experience.
Absolutely created by the place.
Right, and I mean, I could have invented a midwife who was in Thailand or something, but it would have been a really different story.
And so, like, your inciting incident in real life, I talked with this with Terrence Hayes a couple days ago, which is sort of why I'm pulling this together. Is his focus was on, yes, it's great to write these things down, but they come from action in the real world. Mm-hmm. So, like, there's this tie-in of the inciting incident of you talking with this doctor. I mean, completely unexpected, just chatting on the side of the corner in mm-hmm. town, I think. Mm-hmm. And then it led to this revelation of this incredible moment for these people and what was going on with this family and the loss of this man's life. And then it moved forward into the story. And I was wondering if you could maybe just tell us a little bit more. I imagine people will go looking for Hummingbird House. And I'm a little bit curious.
Well,
learned in Guatemala.
I'm not actually writing about that priest. I invented another priest.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of gave that story to another priest, Dixie Ryan. And I wanted to write about the lives of women. I've always been interested in midwifery, and I wanted to have a character who was really close to life and death in this environment where there were just horrific things happening every day. Disappearances, torture, all of that. And so I wanted my female protagonist to be a midwife.
Mm-hmm.
And I just took it from there and kept working over what I would research and working over my story. It took 10 years.
Right.
From the time I got to talk to that doctor until I held the book in my hand. So it was a long, mm-hmm. long journey.
Mm-hmm. And 5 trips to Guatemala.
5 trips to Central America.
Oh, the surrounding
different
countries as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm very happy with that book still.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad I had those experiences. I was so obsessed while I was writing that book. And I don't think I've really felt that since then about a writing project.
Hmm.
I love writing, but I was so deeply committed to that book that I would go anywhere, do anything to get what I needed. I probably took a lot of risks traveling alone.
So not just the fact that you were traveling, because you did mention after the 5th trip that you sort of were like, okay, now is the moment. I have enough. I need to sit
mm-hmm.
down, knuckle down, right, exactly, and write this book.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment, how long did it take you from that point forward to actually was that like at the 5-year mark? Or?
I was accumulating pages all along,
mm-hmm.
so I had a lot of pages. It was a mess. I had probably had 200, 300 pages. And then I had a sabbatical from my university in the winter of 96. I went to New Mexico for 8 months, rented a house there, and that was when I just thought, I've got to get this done or I'll never get it done. And so that was 7 years later,
right.
6 years later from the initial idea.
Right.
And I'd taken all the trips in that intervening time, and I just knew, this is it. If you don't finish it now, you never will.
Mm-hmm.
So I did.
Yeah. And you're finding out that it's like, this making a big difference in the lives of people who are considering adoption.
Yes.
And you know, what a beautiful, like, full circle in a way.
I know. That was wonderful to learn, because the adoption of the child in that book is not the major thing in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So, but apparently it really spoke to people.
And all of these people, whilst being on their possible adoption path, are taking in the additional information about what happened in Guatemala and getting all the you know,
mm-hmm.
history, and wow. So, I think we have time for one more question,
okay.
And then anything else that you want to talk about that I haven't yet asked about.
Okay.
The question I like to ask everyone, and I'm going to ask you to sort of direct this to our listeners, but maybe specifically to the young people who are growing up into, I don't know, life's always been a little uncertain, but maybe we know a little bit more about the uncertainties of today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're exposed at such a younger age to the realities that we're heading into. What would you like to say maybe to young people about how to move forward in a involved way with the world, not frightened of it, not hiding from it or denying it, but willing to sort of accept, embrace, and stay involved. Because I think hope is necessary for people to be able to stay involved or invested in something.
Well, I know it's not very fashionable to say so, but I advise all of my students at Purdue to follow their bliss, to not get caught up in thinking that you graduate from college, you right away have to buy a $250,000 house and own two cars and have 1.5 children and take on all those adult obligations right away. I think it's a big mistake. I think that those things can confine you and keep you from knowing what your true passions are. Mm-hmm. And finding out what your passions are is the number one challenge to young people today. And then following through on those passions, not ignoring them.
I love that answer.
Good.
I love that answer. I completely agree. That's probably why I love it. Okay, thank you. Is there anything else that you would like to bring to this?
Not really. I'm fine to end there on that note. It's been great talking to you and thinking about these things.
Yeah, thank you so much, Patricia.
Talking with Patricia Henley has been a treat, so you can imagine how incredible it was taking her week-long class on the importance of place in fiction. This spring, Patricia will surely be waist-deep in promoting her upcoming young adult novel, Where Wicked Starts. But for those of you on the East Coast, she will be teaching a novel workshop at the Chesapeake Writers Conference this summer, July 6th through the 12th. Titled Your Novel in Your Pocket, all participants will wrestle with the major issues of novel writing, suspense, narrative arc, structure, characterization, place, and end the workshop with maps of their novels and the drive to finish once they go home. From someone on the Pacific who worked with Patricia last summer, I can say I envy you Atlantic coasters. And now on to my second guest author of the hour, Ted Olinger. Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to Voice of Vashon, webcast in real time at voiceofvashon.org, also soon to be available on archive and broadcast on Comcast Channel 21. Today, I'm chatting with Ted Olinger, author of The Woodpecker Menace, a collection of short stories. Ted, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
So, as a quick reminder to our listeners, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is a new show here at Voice of Vashon, with the simple goal of offering authors of fiction, memoir, and poetry an opportunity to discuss how they use their art to inspire social change. Ted, I find that authors have different ways of looking at this question. I'd love to hear, in your words, what your hopes may be when you write a piece about the human experience.
I think the best thing I can hope for is that a reader will learn something in a story that I write that makes them look at a part of themselves in a new way, and hopefully a better way.
Okay, and could you tell us a little bit about where you live? Because place seems to play a significant role in your work, while also creating a few interesting questions in the minds of your readers, which we'll get to in a moment. But why don't you tell us a little bit about that lovely place you call home?
Sure. Key Peninsula, not too very far away from Vashon Island. It's just south of Gig Harbor. It's a pretty narrow peninsula, between 1.5 miles wide, almost 12 miles long. It's got about 65 miles of coastline, you know, like all of Puget Sound. It's got bays and crazy cliffs and all kinds of things. It's very rural. Only one highway runs through it, about maybe 16, 15,000 people hidden throughout the woods there. Logged, you know, at the turn of the century. There's a lot of farms hidden out there. I didn't have any idea it existed before we moved there in 2003 or 2004.
Yeah, I sort of wondered if it was a fictional place or if it actually existed as well. I've never heard of it before.
Well, I've lived there for almost 10 years, and I still wonder if it's fictional or not. There's no there's no town there at all. There are a couple of crossroad communities where we have a couple of stores. You know, your standard, your liquor store, your tobacco store, your tavern, that's it. Mm-hmm. And people come out of the woodwork to these places on you know, Friday night to get all their stuff, and that's where you meet your neighbors, basically. There is quite a strong sense of community there, but just looking at it, you would never guess that. It's just a big tunnel of trees.
And so you make the point of, I mean, yeah, I live on Vashon, right? You know, we have between 11 and 13,000 people, depending on the time of year, and you definitely have a
deeper sense of community in a way. You're more dependent upon each other. You know each other. You see each other more frequently. So you were telling me earlier during your walk that some of your local readers have unique reactions to your stories. I was wondering if you want to take a moment to share some of the funny things that have happened when people have read your stories, and also if you want to clarify something about your narrator's perspective.
Yes, there are 11 stories in this book. They're all fiction, but they were all inspired by either things that I saw or people that I met in and around the Key. Most of the people who have read these stories live on the Key or nearby, and they assume that they're true because all of these stories are written in first person. But the narrator is also a character. It's not me. Hopefully it's somebody that a reader enjoys spending time with, that they'll follow along in the story and go to places that they might not necessarily want to go otherwise. Some of the more, I don't want to say painful, but maybe challenging stories having to do with children who aren't treated the way they should be, perhaps, have gotten some of my neighbors kind of upset, and they've come to me and asked, you know, where these characters are so they can find them and throw them in jail. And right. They don't quite believe me when I say that, you know, this is created. The events that are in this story are made up. It's a story. The point is to convey the emotions behind what's happened or the circumstances that allow these things to happen. Those things are real. And people have a hard time buying that. They want to know, okay, well, I understand you've got a point here, but where's this guy in the story? Because I really want to find him.
Right. Well, your story about the little girl in particular, I had the same reaction. It was like, ooh, is this actually an experience he had and he's writing about it, which is sort of like memoir. Mm-hmm. But I know, and I've clarified with you, that these are definitely fictional short stories. But it was really, so of course, prose, poetry, and purpose is all about the power of the fictional story, and poetry usually is also fictional. It not always, but it can be. Mm-hmm. But the power of something that's not real to impact the real world, right? Mm-hmm. So it seems in a way that when you're able to elicit such a strong reaction in people, it's showing us that there's already like an awareness with what happens to this little girl, that is wrong. And in a way, it's almost like you're wetting the whistle or you're getting the engine moving. So maybe when that person who read the story and had that reaction is walking down a street or is in a situation where they see something happen or there's a neighbor, maybe they'll be more primed, ready, and open to stepping forward and taking action in a productive manner, we hope, and being, you know, making the world a better place through their own personal actions, which is sort of the premise of my show, which is part of why I invited you to come here. I love your work and what it's doing in that way.
Yeah, right. Thank you. And this story that we're talking about is called The Saltwater We Know. And just to so listeners can understand, it's about a little girl who is neglected by her father, basically. There's no violence. Mm-hmm. There's no physical cruelty, but it's not a desirable situation that's described mm-hmm. and that the narrator participates in. Telling this from the first person or even describing something that's, you know, really potentially painful for people to listen to, even at a distance, it's kind of a double-edged sword. One wants to describe the circumstance of a child having to live with parents who don't pay attention to her, who don't meet her basic needs, and you want people to be concerned about that and to think about how in their own lives they could help that child, because there might be one living on their street or might be one in their mm-hmm. school. They're not difficult to find.
Right.
On the other hand, what I'm finding difficult about this collection for people, the fact that it's written first person, it kind of makes it easy for them to think, oh, this happened to you. You saw this. You were in this situation. You took action. It's over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what the point is. I mean, mm-hmm. the point is that this is an ongoing thing. And mm-hmm. I don't want the stories to seem like they're neatly tied up.
Yeah, right. Well, and for me as a reader, my reaction was more of, you know, and the term comes up a number of times in this interview, I think it'll come up as allegory, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. It's like, okay, it's a reminder. Oh yes, this happens, not this happened and is all over. Yeah.
Right.
So thank you, Ted. That is awesome. And as a quick reminder to our listeners, you're tuning into Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon at voiceofvashon.org. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm talking today with Ted Olinger about his collection of short stories titled The Woodpecker Menace. Now, let's get right to the heart of the matter. Woodpeckers.
They are cute and they are pretty. They are often endangered or at risk, and they do perform vital functions for our surrounding ecosystem. Yet in your title story, the narrator is not so happy to have a particular woodpecker around. And I think you have a uniquely personal perspective on this. Is that true?
That is true. That was the inspiration for this whole series of stories, actually, was this particular woodpecker who invaded our home in the spring of 2004, a northern flicker, an infamous character in the woodpecker kingdom, because they're unbelievably stubborn. And like all woodpeckers, they drum to attract a mate. Mm-hmm. And this woodpecker chose our house as his drumming spot. And the sound that a woodpecker can make when it really wants to is unbelievable. And of course, the prime mating hours, evidently, for this guy was 4 to 6 a.m. every morning. And we could not get rid of him. And there's I knew nothing about what this was. The woodpeckers, they're all the same. I mean, who cares, right? Until they come to your house.
At four in the morning.
Yeah, every day. And we had a three-year-old, you know, he didn't go to sleep until 2 in the morning. Anyway, he wouldn't leave. He just would not leave. There's a whole literature on how to deal with woodpeckers. And one of the worst ones is the northern flicker, because they will defend their territory to the death, which means that if you want to get rid of them, you have to have them exterminated. Mm-hmm. That was the inspiration for what's become the title piece of this story. Mm-hmm. And I should say the title, The Woodpecker Menace itself, like many of the titles and other themes of this book, is a bit of a double entendre. I mean, there's the one woodpecker menace, which I just described, sleep deprivation. And the other is what dealing with this threat actually does to yourself, or what it can do. When you open yourself to other possibilities besides the obvious, which is killing the bird.
And I believe you are going to read a bit of this juicy story for us today.
I would like to. Thank you. This is just a quick section. It's right in the middle where the narrator is starting to make an involuntary internal transition from wanting to kill this animal to identifying with it. Like all migratory birds, the northern flicker is a protected species. However, the federal government has kindly provided, in its familiar, tortured fashion, a process by which one may obtain a permit to kill a woodpecker that is damaging property or driving a young family insane. My years in uniform had made me a competent rifleman, and I have been known to trim lofty tree branches with a shotgun, but I was not eager to start blasting holes in the side of my house to kill a bird. I took the decision seriously. With the grim and disciplined patience appropriate for such a measure, I began the tedious filing and phone calling necessary to obtain the two permits that would become my license to kill. In June, I was still waiting for my Section 37 form from the Department of Agriculture. The dawn hammering and three-year-old boy door kicking open were by now a way of life. Out of frustration, I had taken to shooting clay pigeons at a local gun club. Even my wife, who will use half a roll of toilet paper to capture a spider and safely deliver it outdoors, demanded bloody justice. To add insult, the flicker had grown bold enough to continue hammering on our roof even while I sat quietly on the deck below, now drinking straight gin and grinding my teeth. That was his mistake, however, because he gave me my plan. The suet baskets went up, the plastic owl was recycled. We no longer shouted and waved our arms at the roof like the hapless maniacs we had become. We ignored the flicker and thus made him feel safe. Our boy now sometimes slept through the pre-dawn hammering, and he missed it. On such mornings, he would eagerly step out on the back deck and bellow into the woods, "Woo-pecker! Woo-pecker!" scaring off all wildlife in a 100-yard radius. When the flicker invariably returned, the boy secretly studied him through an empty cardboard tube that served as telescope. His growing attachment troubled me, for I knew now how it would end. The flicker would hammer as usual in the morning. Our boy would go to preschool. My wife would go to work. The dogs would go to their kennel. I would sit, maybe for hours, hiding in plain sight on the deck with a shotgun and crossword puzzle on my lap. As I waited for the paperwork, I began to dread its arrival. I was preparing to kill a real animal whose plushy stuffed counterpart had a place on our boy's bed, and perhaps in his heart. The more I contemplated our struggle, the more I began to admire this bird. He was stronger than me, or at least more stubborn.
Okay, that's bringing back all the memories from the first time I read it. I thank you for your humor too. I personally am not a very funny person, and I just so admire the humorist. So,
thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, just thank you for that.
Yeah, yeah. As you wrote this story, would you say you purposely intended it to become the allegory or example to your readers of how humans as a whole have approached our natural environment, our fellow earthlings? Or do you think that that ended up being an accident?
It was definitely an accident. When this problem arrived in the form of the woodpecker, we did take it seriously, did a lot of research into what that bird is about. It's a keystone species. It depends on dead wood in the forest to excavate. Other animals live in those dens. And it really serves an important important purpose in the ecosystem. And I had no idea. So that was a strike against eliminating it, of course. We had to find some way to accommodate it. But allowing it to, destroy our gutter and go after our flashing wasn't going to be an option either. Mm. So we had to really think outside the box, as the phrase goes, and come up with solutions that nobody had really suggested. We just kept trying over and over and over again until we could reach an agreement with it.
And so that's the piece, like, so in the past, in sustainable cultures, even today in sustainable cultures, human beings, their language, the way they view the world is different from the language of domination or extraction-based empire-like cultures. Like when they study some of these Amazonian tribes, the few remaining ones, they'll discover that the language is lacking words such as murder or theft or steal. You know, it doesn't exist as a concept. And so what I really love about this story is that you're a person living in this current modern day culture, and you had an experience where there was a shift from sort of the top down humans get to use all the world and control it and shape it and make it to be comfortable to them. And you had that option, but there was a shift, and we don't need to go into it because I want people to read the story and get it in that way. But that shift, you know, it would be really nice to see the larger society make a similar shift to cohabitation with our environment rather than a false belief that we are separate from, because we aren't. We just sort of like perceive it that way.
Yeah, exactly. That was sort of a strange reward to this whole misadventure. Advice we kept getting over and over again was you have to kill the bird, which we like birds. We like animals. And as I said in the story, our boy was getting kind of attached to it. And frankly, so was I. I really did kind of admire this ridiculous campaign of his to, like, you know, mate at 4 o'clock in the morning on our roof, even though it went on for months and months. But the fact that we decided, well, decide is not the right word. The fact that we came to realize that eliminating him really wasn't something we wanted to do forced us to think about options that we hadn't considered, and finally accommodating him. And that's without saying too much about the story. You know, his descendants live with us now in the same place. And we get along fine. There's no more destruction or anything else. Mm-hmm. That wasn't part of a master plan. That was sort of a benefit to deciding that we're going to find a solution rather than impose our will, I guess might be the best way to put it.
And so here you are with this wonderful personal experience that turns into a message, a powerful emotional story, and you take the time and you're willing to write it down and make it so hilarious and offer it to the world. It is a story that works because it has punch and it has risk built into it. It has a really good hook, as it were, with an unexpected resolution at the end. I'm wondering, because sometimes I've read other, like this one, somehow I just sort of knew it was going to come out good. But there are other stories where I've gotten a few pages in, and if there's a character who's doing something that I'm that uncomfortable with, I'll just stop because I don't have a trust that the author is going to take me to a good place. And I'm pretty protective of what goes into my head. Mm-hmm. You know, like I don't watch horror movies. I mean, there are things that once an image is in my head or a story is in my head, it sticks. And so I'm pretty cautious. I'm wondering, have you ever had an experience where a reader was unwilling to stick with your story long enough to get there to the end? And what was that like for you as an author?
Yes, I have the archetypal experience for that. And it is with this story, The Woodpecker Menace. It was originally published, I think, in 2005 or somewhere around there in a magazine back east. And it had a little bit of reaction, but the most significant reaction came from another writer for that magazine, to paraphrase her reaction, called it repugnant because it contemplated the killing of this woodpecker. And, you know, it went on from there. And, you know, I was taken aback and kind of hurt. And the more I read it, the more it occurred to me that maybe she hadn't finished the whole story.
Right.
So I sent a message back asking whether she had done so. And I got another fiery response back saying, you know, no, it was too painful for her to go on. So, like, that was the end of the communication. But I wasn't convinced that the failure really wasn't on her part there for having a little bit of faith that this was actually going to work out, mm-hmm. rather than it being a manifesto of, you know, how to exterminate pests.
Right. You know, anytime I've known a lot about a particular subject and I've read a newspaper article about that subject, it's abysmal. You know, it's like 95% wrong and probably mm-hmm. the other 5% is manipulative, you know, and it's just important for people to keep delving deeper and look for alternative voices on subjects mm-hmm. and to continue to move forward in exploring something at enough depth that you can oftentimes start to discover there are options. You know, if someone comes to you and says, well, you can have this or that, like we recently had the Franciscan health system took over Highline, which means they're now in control of our local clinic. And one of the options presented in the local newspaper was, if we piss them off, they may leave, we'll lose the clinic entirely, so we should accept what they're offering.
Right.
It's a one or the other, only two options. And already on Vashon, there's all these people who have gathered together and they're looking for the third option.
Right.
And Vashon excels at finding the third option. They're like, no, neither of those are okay. We're going to find a better option. So, you know, I love that your story shows there's another better option. It wasn't just suffer or kill the bird.
Right.
There was a third option.
Right. And from a reader's point of view, I mean, it's hopefully the story is entertaining enough. You know, give it the benefit of the doubt till you get to the end and then make all the judgments you want, because then you have all the information at your fingertips, but you're not going to get there without an open mind and, you know, a few minutes on your hands.
Right. So again, real quick, for those of you just joining us, I'm Marge Twisdale. You're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon. I'm talking with Ted Olinger, local author of The Woodpecker Menace, a collection of short stories with real world appeal. I have one more question for you, but before we get to that, I was hoping you would read to us from one of my favorite stories in your collection, My Anarchist Neighbor.
Yes, absolutely.
That would be lovely.
Like the woodpecker story, where you know, the characters are confronted with this somewhat nightmarish animal, another element of living in a rural place, at least our rural place, is the somewhat nightmarish people. Or people who might appear nightmarish mm-hmm. until you get to know them. And one of the reasons we weren't going to live there was this guy at the end of the road. And as it happened, we've been there for 10 years and we became good friends. But, well, I'll just read it and you can see. This is called My Anarchist Neighbor. I was behind the wheel of my neighbor's truck, spinning donuts on my lawn, when I realized that I had wasted my life. The crisis began when I asked to borrow his rototiller. It was, I thought, a harmless request. Our new front lawn was nothing but a wide, sprawling weed bed that tormented my sleep. With spring's ever gradual arrival, I decided to rip it out and begin again. Why don't you see if the neighbor has a rototiller we can borrow? My wife was determined that at least one of us meet the man at the end of our gravel road. This was just another excuse. In fact, we were his new neighbors. Our small family had just that winter moved to the rural outcropping in South Puget Sound that is the Key Peninsula, and I had already expended tremendous effort into not meeting the neighbor. I knew by reputation that he had enjoyed a long career on the peninsula as some kind of survivalist logger, trading wood for tobacco, alcohol, and ammunition. Well into his 70s, he lived alone in an aging trailer with a detached outhouse and no electricity, plunked down in the middle of a large compound patrolled by three chihuahuas and a flightless cockatiel. The perimeter was a blasted battlefield of wood fragments where he'd hand-split massive rounds of timber for decades. The ground was littered with the relics of his trade. Axes, wedges, mauls, spools of rusted cable, bent and broken chain hoists, and the carcasses of half a dozen vehicles shrouded in plastic blue tarp. All of this was sprawled under the shadow of an enormous American flag, which he dutifully hoisted every morning, upside down. A man like that must own a rototiller, my wife insisted. So, and it goes on from there.
I know.
And he's comes across as kind of a hard character you really wouldn't want to associate with. But as with most things, You get to know it well enough and, you know, find a way to work with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've got a couple of friends and they are a little rough looking on the exterior, but they have hearts of gold, mm-hmm. you know, underneath all the experiences and traumas of especially like Vietnam vets and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I really, okay. So, all right. So last question
mm-hmm.
for all of our listeners, but maybe even more so for the young people growing into these convoluted and challenging times. I'm wondering what reason for hope you would like to share with them.
Well, I think I got a short answer and a long answer. And the short answer would be that there are always possibilities, which I think is something I learned from Star Trek. But yes. I only mean that half jokingly, because Star Trek is a great story, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's been going on for 40 years now in some iteration. And the long version of that is that storytelling itself has been going on since from the beginning. That's the first mark of humanity. We kind of tell the same stories over and over and over again, hoping that we're going to get them right eventually. And I think we're getting closer and closer. The stories in this book are very small, about a very small part of the world. But they're about real people, real emotions, real events, real solutions. But you don't get to those solutions without engaging fully.
Mm-hmm.
If you can do that, which requires a lot. It requires keeping your mind open, your mouth shut sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Requires a lot of time, and it requires a little bit of courage that you might not think that you have. At the end of that story, you will find some hope.
Yep. There's short stories that you've written here, but with definite global relevancy.
Well, I think the globe starts inside each of our own hearts, then yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. Yep. We're people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you very much for talking with me today. I so very much appreciate your willingness to share yourself, the years of writing, your time, and your work with the rest of us.
Thank you, March. It was a pleasure. I think I came across better on paper than on tape, but we'll find out.
No, you're absolutely lovely, and you're excellent on paper. So that is awesome. I'm so excited to have had you come over to the island and go walking with you. It's been great. So I'd like to thank my listeners for tuning in to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, my new show here on Voice of Vashon. If you caught us halfway through, you've been listening to my interview with local author and Key Peninsula's annual infamous chili cook-off champion of 2010, Ted Olinger. Check out his website, woodpeckermenace.com, to learn more about his collection of short stories and future events. You can learn more at my Prose, Poetry, and Purpose tab on the new, recently launched VOV website, where you can also listen to my archived shows. My name is Marge Twisdale, program host and producer. If you have a favorite author who inspires you to believe in yourself and the future, who you'd like me to interview, send an email to marchpower@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Next month, I'll be interviewing Sarah Collins Honenberger, author of two true stories turned to fiction, White Lies and Catcher Caught. And now we'll end once again with our island's own Cami Lundin and her breakout title song, Run Free.
Runs in the mountains like the sun sets beyond the sea, like the wind blows through the trees on a crisp autumn evening, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still, it can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. And be who you were made to be. Run wild and find the beauty that hides inside, that hides inside. Like the moon floats in the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on a stormy night. Why?